A big win for Senator Hillary Clinton, where Pennsylvania voters handed her a big win.
I might stumble and I might get knocked down, but as long as you'll stand with me, I will always get right back up.
Back up she was, beating rival Senator Barack Obama, who spent far more money. The race is still on for the Democratic presidential nomination. Good morning and get ready. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Barack Obama's mind is on to the next primary. He's in the 812 area code this morning, Evansville, Indiana.
Now it's up to you, Indiana.
Oh, so Indiana's now the decider. After Pennsylvania, three questions in this crazy campaign. Has Obama become George McGovern? Has Clinton become Hubert Humphrey? And is John McCain now Richard Nixon? Oh my gosh, it's a 1968 time warp.
In other headlines, Jordan's King Abdullah has a private breakfast with President Bush this morning. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will meet with Bush tomorrow in anticipation of the president's Middle East trip next month, and he is aiming at a final attempt to broker a peace deal before his term is up. He's only got so many months left.
That'll work.
President Bush is also talking about the U.S. economy, and this after 2 days of international trade talks at the North American Leaders Summit in New Orleans. He had this to say.
We're not in a recession. We're in a slowdown. We grew in the fourth quarter last year. We haven't had first quarter growth statistics yet, but there's no question we're in a slowdown.
Many might debate him on that. President Bush was speaking after meeting with Canadian Prime Minister, I should say the Canadian Prime Minister, and the Mexican President.
Slowdown or not, the U.S. dollar hit a all-time low against the euro, 160. Oil is at $120 a barrel today, and the Dow begins the day down 104 points. The government is saying never mind to a $20 million virtual fence along the Arizona-Mexican border, where virtual immigrants apparently cross. The fence consists of nine electronic surveillance towers along the border southwest of Tucson. Customs and Border Protection officials say it doesn't work very well. It fails to alert Border Patrol agents. The virtual fence will be replaced with new real towers, radars, cameras, and computers.
Virtual immigrants, John?
Well, maybe that's what it was for.
Okay.
I don't know.
In New York, an 84-year-old American citizen faces federal charges. He's accused of spying for the Israeli government by passing on military secrets, and that included sensitive U.S. nuclear weapon information. Ben Ami Kadish was a former Army mechanical engineer at the New Jersey base in the 1980s.
Free Bibles! No, don't do that. The judge ruled in Louisiana that a school board free Bible program violated the Constitution. It was a violation of separation of church and state. So if you're the head of the Democratic Party today, you've got a headache.
You've got a lot of headaches.
Big headache.
In fact, that's our takeaway question for the day. We want to know if you were the head of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, if you were Howard Dean, how would you get the party out of this stalemate?
Send us your scenarios. What would you do if you were Howard Dean to end this gridlock in the nomination process? Send your ideas to mytake@thetakeaway.org, and just having Dean scream really loudly and stomp up and down doesn't count. We want something real, not just clever sarcasm. All right, I'll be in charge of that department. Okay. Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We're following the major developments in the Democratic race for the nomination to be president of the United States. Hillary Rodham Clinton, who won in Pennsylvania last night, said the tide is turning in her favor. She beat Barack Obama by just under 10 points there in Pennsylvania. Obama still leads in overall delegates, but Clinton has narrowed the gap, though not by that much. In fact, it's a bit surprising. She won roughly 66 delegates to Obama's 57, probably not surprising to those who are following very, very closely, but you always think, Andrea Bernstein, that when you win a state, right, that you walk away with a whole big bundle of delegates, but maybe not so much in that case. But still, it's a win for Hillary Clinton, very important to her campaign.
It is. And once again, here we are, and she is alive to fight another day. And that's the message she's giving on the morning shows this morning. She's been doing the rounds of, I think, 6 television morning shows, and she's been saying, we're here, we're fighting forward. She says that she raised $3 million last night
it's
after
up to three
her Pennsylvania
now.
Victory.
Three, yeah.
It's up to three now. So it's they are really sort of saying we are alive. And for them, I mean, I think pretty much after Super Tuesday, it stopped being about delegates for them and started being about persuading superdelegates to go their way.
So you're talking momentum. That's Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director who was in Pennsylvania last night. Also joining us today is John Broder from the New York Times. He is with the Clinton campaign. And John, sum up how you think, or what you know actually, is what the Clinton campaign is saying now is their road to victory.
Well, they have pivoted the conversation from delegates to popular vote. Their margin last night, although I haven't seen the final figures, was roughly 200,000 votes, which narrows the popular vote margin, depending on whether you count Florida and how you count the caucus states, down to around 500,000 votes. And they believe quite strongly in the remaining 9 contests they can close that gap, and in fact, on June 3rd, at the end of the primary process, be able to point to a popular vote superiority over Mr. Obama.
John and Andrea, to both of you, I mean, make that calculation. Let's talk popular vote for a moment. If you add the raw votes from Michigan and Florida, Barack Obama could come in, depending on how you do the arithmetic, only 250,000 ahead. I mean, that's sort of a dead heat if you're talking November. Would either of you do the math that way?
The popular vote has become part of the currency of the discussion about this race, but it's sort of like, you know, Potemkin, where they focus in on the meat and it's all full of maggots. I mean, what is the popular vote?
I was thinking
vote?
Of the scene rolling down the steps.
Vivid,
yeah,
vivid.
I was thinking of the baby carriage
right,
scene.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's the popular vote. I mean, think about it. Pennsylvania, only registered Democrats could vote. New Hampshire, anybody could vote, and anybody can register that day. New York, you had to change your registration 3 months in advance, so it becomes
very confusing.
All
right, so you're savvy, you're brilliant. Okay, but do superdelegates get persuaded, John Broder, by these kinds of arguments?
I frankly don't think so, although I can't get inside their heads. There's about 300 left who haven't declared. One fewer today, I understand. The governor of Oklahoma, I think, is going to endorse Senator Obama, which raises his superdelegate count one. They're going to have a hard time explaining how they go against the delegate map, and that's how the process is set up. It really has nothing to do with the popular vote.
I think that is what I've heard a lot of them say, that they are worried about the sort of how the delegates themselves vote. But for Hillary Clinton last night, she won by 10 points, but she was able to sort of advance the argument that she's making. Why can't Barack Obama end this? He's got much more money. He's won more states. He's got the momentum. Lots of people think he's going to be the nominee. And her argument is, well, if that's the case, why isn't he picking up these big states? And that's her argument to the superdelegates that, oh, my goodness, big problem in November if we can't win Pennsylvania, if we can't win California.
Was saying last night. I mean, Pat Buchanan and Hillary Clinton agree on something. Why can't Barack Obama close it out?
Yeah,
I'm a viable candidate.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and here's my question to you, John Broder, is when I hear something like that, it makes me think, but wait a second, Hillary Clinton. A year ago, you were the preordained leader in this race. Why haven't you closed the deal? A year ago, most voters in Pennsylvania, I would bet a lot, had no idea who Barack Obama was.
Well, clearly she entered this race with formidable advantages and has managed to squander just about all of them, including, you know, the name recognition, the money advantage. She had supposedly the smartest political analyst on the planet in Bill Clinton in her corner, and none of that's really worked out. She's had a good night raising money last night, but she's still practically in the red while he's sitting on a $40 million war chest.
And in terms of the actual the numbers itself, I have seen some observers say that in order for her to actually pick up the delegates that she needs in the remaining contest and persuade the superdelegates, she would need to get something like 70% of the votes in the next handful of contests. Andrea, you think that's the case?
You know, I think that the math has to go miraculously well in her direction. But I think one of the things that's happening here is that Democrats do not want to blow this one. They want to win it.
They're blowing it, but they're blowing it.
Well,
see, look, they have handed here. Look, both of you, listen to me. They have handed the Republicans an argument. Barack Obama cannot get the Reagan blue-collar Democrat swing voters, whereas Barack Obama can bring in these new young voters, but it's unclear whether they're going to be decisive. You've really handed John McCain a way of driving a wedge in the Democratic electorate and gives them much more plausibility for November.
Perhaps. But Pennsylvania is now bluer than it ever was. 400,000 new Democrats registered in Pennsylvania. And it's happened in each state, and it's where there's been a primary, lots of new Democrats getting involved in the process. So one could
also...
And
they're going to all vote for Hillary Clinton, you think?
I think that the Democrats think the stakes are very, very high this year. They're upset about Iraq. They're upset about the economy. They're upset about what they see as the subversion of the Constitution. It's hard for me to believe those people who feel so strongly are going to vote for John McCain in November.
John?
Okay.
Well,
John.
The one other point that the Clinton campaign has managed to successfully obscure is, yes, we're quite aware of what Obama's weaknesses are, but Senator Clinton has some weaknesses and vulnerabilities, too. And it's not that she's a woman, it's that she's a Clinton. And they may have overestimated how much the people long to return to the drama-filled days of Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Let me ask you a question, John. You are with the Hillary campaign, and Indiana, very close race in some of the polling that we've had up to this point. In North Carolina, which both of them have primaries on May 6th, Obama's been leading her in the polls. So how do they now go and campaign, and are they anticipating some kind of bounce after this win in Pennsylvania?
I think the Clinton people certainly are. You know, her language last night, which she alluded to at the top of the show, "The Tide is Turning," is the title of their morning email. I assume we'll hear that phrase again on the stump in Indianapolis when we get there. I think she'll say, you know, go with the winner, Barack Obama just can't manage to close the sale.
See, I think May 6th is really ugly for the Democrats in that you've got North Carolina as a kind of a service, new techie economy with also a sizable African-American population against Indiana, which is another blue-collar state with some tough sort of economic issues there. Seems like if they split it, it's again saying to McCain, hey, come on in.
Well, I think that one of the issues that we should watch in the next 2 weeks is, you know, Hillary Clinton closed out this campaign in Pennsylvania with this ad with Osama bin Laden in it, which
That's
is
crazy.
A tactic that we have so far only seen in Republican commercials. And I think we should watch to see whether that is something that she deploys further and whether that makes her vulnerable to what Barack Obama said last night. We need to prove not only that we know how to win, but that we should win.
So if you're Howard Dean, Andrea. What do you do? What do you do? We're asking everyone listening. What do you do?
If I'm Howard Dean, I probably go hide my head in the sand. I mean, I think one of the problems is that Florida and Michigan were completely bungled by the Democrats.
Yeah.
Why they didn't do what the Republicans did, which is say, okay, your punishment is you lose half your delegates, but there should still be a campaign, and this issue would be put away.
Of course, so listeners, that's too long for an email. We hope your suggestions, if you're
much
Howard
shorter.
Dean, would be shorter. John,
you got a shorter one there for us?
All right.
What do you do if you're dean? That's much shorter. What do you do if you're dean? You go, oh. I love that.
I mean, he's in a tight spot, isn't he? John?
Oh, Howard Dean?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's in an impossible position. He helped to put himself there. But don't forget, too, that the penalties against Florida and Michigan were voted on by the DNC's Rules Committee, which is a fairly large group of people. That includes Harold Ickes, who's Hillary Clinton's chief delegate strategist. He realized that these were rule breakers, that they had agreed on the four early primary states in January. No one else could go before that. So it's a bit disingenuous of them to argue that those things ought to count when her own campaign, and she herself last October said everybody knows that Michigan isn't going to count, and the same thing was true of Florida.
So there's enough blame to go around on the Florida and Michigan debacle.
And maybe the Democratic Party could use a successor to Howard Dean. John Broder and Andrea Bernstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Guys are so great. We didn't even get to any of the tape we had in the hour, and of course we'll get in trouble for that. But thanks for a fascinating conversation.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks. Take care. Okay.
John, who are we going to get in trouble with? Who's going to?
We are the masters.
I was going to say.
We are the masters.
We have the mics.
Yes. And email us at mytake@takeaway.org.
You can email us at talkback@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 800-543-2543.
543-2543.
We have some other headlines today, and for that, we turn to Femi. Okay, hi there, Femi.
Hello there. Hillary Clinton is talking about her Pennsylvania primary win on the morning talk shows. She calls her victory an incredible development. In other news around the U.S., the pilot of a container ship that spilled 53,000 gallons of oil into San Francisco's bay last November has been charged. He faces environmental misdemeanor charges and criminal charges for lying about his prescription drug use to Coast Guard officials. With the huge rise in fuel costs, Delta's CEO, Richard Anderson, says airlines will have to charge passengers at least 15% more just to break even. He also warned about a cutback in flights. A high school student in South Carolina faces a federal charge of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction. 18-year-old Ryan Schallenberger was arrested Saturday for a scheme to detonate explosives in a suicide attack on his high school. And finally, as the fight to pick a Democrat presidential candidate continues, John McCain is spending time in Youngstown, Ohio, drawing attention to the economy and free trade. He also faced some rather feisty questions. One audience member suggested that NAFTA was a four-letter word. Here's McCain's response.
I am prone on occasion to make a mistake. Last time I checked, NAFTA is five letters.
He's ready to be commander-in-chief, that's clear.
He's a funny man.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
You can't put anything by him. No, it's five letters. Yeah. Give him the codes for the bombs.
I'm glad he can count.
Yeah.
You're being mean today.
Am I? Yeah.
Yeah.
I need to adjust my medication.
It's Wednesday.
Can we work on that in the control room, please?
What is
medication?
Say?
A little more nitrous this way? Thank
that's
you.
That's a wrap on the news. I'll see you later.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As perhaps the rest of the world knows, maybe less than people here in the United States, the world does not stop while the U.S. chooses a president. And setting the agenda is actually more difficult for a lame duck president in the middle of a campaign. And try though he might, President Bush has been attempting to set the economic agenda here in this hemisphere and around the world with limited success. And we decided to invite two guests in to talk about the global agenda in the midst of a campaign. Joining us now is Eduardo Porter, who's a member of the New York Times editorial board. He joins us from New York. Good morning, Eduardo. Also with us is Cassandra Walden, who's Chief of External Communications for the United Nations Development Program. Cassandra, thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure to be with you.
Eduardo, you know, let's start with you. The president is attempting to set the agenda in the waning hours of his campaign on issues that normally would not appear to be so controversial. Let's talk about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement to begin with. The president, as recently as yesterday, was talking about this. How does the president set the agenda here? Why has it become so controversial? And what's the real stumbling block?
Well, I think President Bush sees this as an important part of his legacy, the Colombian FTA, and that's perhaps why he's been pushing so hard to get this deal, which to others might seem minor. Now, why it's become so controversial, first, I would perhaps disagree with the fact that these sorts of deals have not been controversial of late. In fact, free trade deals have been very, very controversial throughout the Bush administration and even before. I mean, just try to remember Clinton's battle to ratify NAFTA.
NAFTA, I mean, NAFTA is all over this campaign. We've got both of the candidates talking about NAFTA. Take a listen to this, and we'll talk about it when you come back.
Canada is negotiating a Colombia free trade agreement. Mexico has a free trade agreement with Colombia. And a lot of folks are waiting for the United States Congress to bring this issue up and pass it.
That, of course, was the president talking about the Colombia free trade agreement. But as you know, Clinton and Barack Obama have been talking about NAFTA over and over again. It is controversial, but I guess, you know, my impression to what you just said is if Bush's legacy has slipped to a Colombia free trade agreement, That seems far down the ladder of importance for the kinds of things that presidents typically think of as their legacy, Mideast peace agreements, that sort of thing.
Well, indeed, I would agree with that observation. Nonetheless, he does think this to be a really big deal, and he's going down to the wire to get it passed.
And Eduardo, what do you think his chances are? I mean, I recall last month he was saying that he was going to push this proposal on a fast track, but he was stymied by Congress. Where does that stand now? He's still talking about it, but what can he really do about it?
Look, it's a tough one to call because we're in kind of uncharted territory. President submitted it to Congress. They signed it in a couple of years ago in 06. And they'd been trying to get a deal with Congress so they could submit it in more kind of like amicable terms to get it passed. When the administration wasn't able to do this, they decided to try to force the matter and submitted the deal against the will of Democrats in Congress, thinking that because of the rules that govern these sorts of things, Congress would have a certain period of time to say yay or nay to the pact, to the free trade agreement, and that many Democrats would at the end of the day vote yes. However, Nancy Pelosi pulled a tactic that the administration wasn't expecting, which was suspending the clock, which just leaves it frozen in limbo.
Right. I mean, no wiggle room for the Bush administration on this.
Right, exactly. Sure. Right now, it doesn't seem they can do anything directly.
Right.
However, from what Pelosi and other members of Congress, other Democrats in Congress have said, there does seem to be some room for negotiation. It seems Democrats are very interested in an expansion of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, and they've been asking for this for a long time, and the White House hasn't been paying any attention.
Clearly
there would be room to negotiate this against the Colombian FTA. I am not sure that this will happen, but it perhaps could happen.
Yeah, well, if the campaign stops, gets out of gridlock, perhaps the Democrats will have time to focus on something besides the campaign. Let's broaden this out a little bit, Cassandra. The Bush administration spent a lot of the first term talking about a potential legacy in places like Africa on AIDS and
poverty.
Is that a place where the Bush administration is attempting to, carve out some kind of legacy in its waning months in 2008?
I think that's very true. I mean, President Bush was recently in the region, and he was actually received like a rock star.
He was.
Because people perceive him to be someone who has made a major impact, particularly on HIV/AIDS, poverty, on democratic governance. The U.S. has been a great supporter of countries which have made strides on elections, on transparency, on fighting corruption. So I think that Africans, by and large, see President Bush as a friend. They've seen a lot of progress over the last 8 years of him focusing on African issues. He's been to the region twice. That's a really important thing, and it's made a lot of news in the region.
It argues for a constitutional change in the United States. We should have two presidents, the one that's running and then one that's the lame duck president who deals with the important issues.
And I want to say something else, just going back to the trade issue. I mean, he's really facing some trouble with NAFTA and with the Colombia trade agreement. But I will tell you that at the global scale, developing countries are very frustrated because their own trade talks across the globe with the rich countries are going very slowly. So this is not a problem that only President Bush is facing with his own particular agenda and legacy. It's something that is spilling over across the globe. And we see that with African countries trying to push the rich countries further into a more equitable
and
trade
especially
relationship.
Especially given the global food crisis.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about that. Right. Cassandra's going to stay with us. Eduardo, very quickly before we go, do the Democrats have any chance of renegotiating NAFTA if they get into the White House? Is that actually going to happen?
I doubt it. It's not impossible, but I doubt it. It is a very, very big deal. The United States trades about worth $1 trillion with Canada and Mexico. And Canada and Mexico don't really want it reopened. If it were reopened, they'd probably have their own items on the agenda that they'd want to change.
Thanks, Eduardo. Eduardo Porter of the New York Times editorial board. And from the Nerve Center here at The Takeaway, More news headlines from Femi Okay.
Iran has agreed to cooperate with a UN investigation into allegations of the country's attempt to develop nuclear weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it hopes Iran will provide clarification on its nuclear program by next month. Violence continues just in the eastern side of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Anuka Woodenberg from Human Rights Watch said the situation is dire.
The human rights and humanitarian situation in eastern Congo continues to be catastrophic. Lots of people continue to die. We have documented scores of killings since January when a peace agreement was signed.
Human Rights Watch is just one of the groups which supports a peace agreement signed between the Congolese government and armed rebel groups. And finally, a little tidbit for you. Two of the most popular names in Kenya, babies are now being named Raila and Kofi.
Raila and Kofi.
Yes. As an Annan, the
As
former
Kofi Annan?
UN chief?
Yes.
No, Kofi Gillespie, the rock star. I mean, come on.
There are a lot.
How many Kofis are there?
He's good.
A lot.
His records.
There are. That's right. There are a lot in Kenya. Thank you, Femi.
In Ghana, too.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project. Provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Jeff Deck, there in Missoula, Montana. Jeff, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good. How about you?
Just fine. You've been on the road for 6 weeks, right?
I have.
Price of gas at the beginning of your trip was?
It was in the 310s in New England.
And today it's something like what?
It's in the high 340s in Missoula, Montana right now.
So Jeff Deck has been traveling across the country for the past 6 weeks on a project called the Typo Eradication Advancement League. That's actually to correct grammar across the U.S. And normally we might want to talk about that with you, Jeff. But in the middle of this spiking energy crisis, we were actually more interested in your energy costs, because you would think that a traveling across the country grammar improvement project would actually be a pretty cheap thing to do, but not so in 2008, correct?
No, definitely not.
So your nice idea has become a crazy idea.
Well, it always was a crazy idea, but now it's crazier.
Where was the highest price of gas, and how does it make you change your calculation for how you get through the day? Because I suspect you're on a fairly limited budget.
Well, it was California, where the gas prices were ranged from the 380s to $4. I believe they had some sort of fuel surcharge added in there. It didn't really make me change the way I was going about this trip, though, because it's driving across America, and it's more efficient than taking the bus.
More efficient than taking the bus. And there's better grammar in your car than there is on the bus. Jeff Deck, thank you very much for joining us. And we'll check in with you again, both on energy prices and on how America's grammar is doing. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Lisa Marganelli, who's the author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline. Jeff Deck's adventure is a bit of a microcosm for all Americans and really people all over the world who are recalculating their monthly income on the basis of energy costs. Oil hit $120 a barrel yesterday, coupled with the weakening U.S. dollar. I mean, this is having impacts everywhere in economies all over the world. Lisa, where do you think this is going?
Oh, it's really hard to tell where this is going. You know, we used to describe globalization as a butterfly flaps its wings in China, and, you know, there's an earthquake in Paris, and this is just multiple butterflies. And
wait, it's multiple baseball bats.
Yeah,
this is outrageous.
It's really nuts. And, you know, it's one of these things, the oil economy, oil made a fluid economy, and, it, you know, this has been growing since perhaps 1900, this sort of global economy of oil. And a single tanker can change hands 300 times from the time it sets out from an oil port.
300 times?
300 times. Yeah, that's how fluid it is.
Let's talk quickly about this precise issue of, you know, in an environment where the financial sector is in trouble, stocks are a risky bet.
Mm-hmm.
Gold is down from its $1,000 an ounce record. People are looking to oil to hedge their wealth and are actually speculating in the oil markets, and that's part of what's driving these prices?
That's part of what's driving it. Part of the other thing is people like Jeff and like me who have seen gas double in the past 5 years and haven't taken our foot off the gas. I mean, it's not like Jeff canceled his trip or he's carpooling all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, there's some things have to go on. Grammar improvement has to go on. We can't be sacrificing that.
Unnecessary apostrophes are despicable. But the other thing that's happening is you know, drivers all over the world are watching GDP improve, and they're continuing to drive. People now, people buy more gas not because it's cheap, but because their own GDP or their own wealth is growing. You've got nationalism in the countries that have the oil. More and more, the oil reserves are concentrated in the hands of OPEC countries, and they're not investing more in bringing more oil to the surface. They're investing in other things.
Well, Lisa, you know, the oil market is something that we, you know, need to continually check in with you on. We have to move on to a different segment here. But, you know, the idea that speculators are driving the price, that a single tanker can change hands 300 times, not only are we talking about a changed oil market and an oil price market, but we're talking about oil really plugged into the entire global economy. Thank you very much for joining us. Lisa Marganelli is author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline. Adventures, yeah.
And the cost of oil is just aggravating an already truly troubled global food crisis that just seems to be getting bigger and wider every day.
Egyptian police fire tear gas to try to disperse crowds after 2 days of demonstrations. The anger here at low wages and rising food prices is such that people ignore laws against holding protests like this. Almost 200 have been arrested since Monday and scores injured.
That's the BBC's Jane Haddon reporting, and calls for actions are going louder as the food prices continue to skyrocketing, and they're triggering security concerns and fears of continued violence. And we're talking about prices for basic food things like rice and maize and wheat, and they just keep getting higher and higher. Now, food here in the United States is expensive, Cassandra, but it's far more disastrous, those rises in prices in places like Africa. And we're talking with Cassandra Walden, the Chief of External Communications at the UNDP. So what can be done? Who's calling for actions? It looks like, sounds like, advocacy groups and governments are on the same page, are they?
I think today we can say that there's a real understanding that this is a problem which is affecting everyone, and that those who have the least capacity to cope need action now. You've heard a call for the Group of Eight Industrialized Nations to put this on their agenda when they get together in Japan later this year. You have the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, calling for an international conference on this issue, and people are really starting to step up to the plate and begin to discuss what can be done now to help improve the situation poor people are facing. And we're, you know, we in the United States, we go to buy our Triscuits, the prices are increased. We go to buy Snapple, the prices are increased. Maybe we have to cut back on the amount of times we go out every week, the number of times we go out every week for dinner.
And again, that ripples through the economy.
Exactly.
That's an employment question right there.
Exactly.
Let's talk about influence here. Does the UN have influence here? Indonesia last week took its rice crop off the market to preserve domestic tranquility. Yeah. That had ripples around the world.
Absolutely. I think we do have influence, but we recognize we are one partner among many, and we need to sit down at the table and really discuss this with governments and with experts. There are solutions out there, and there are some countries which are actually doing the right thing. I mean, Ethiopia, a country which we know has been famous for its famines and captured the hearts and minds of Americans 20 years ago through We Are the World, through you know, many different efforts to raise money to help feed the Ethiopians. Today, they are opening their own markets to ensure that traders and farmers get together to take better advantage of the market.
But has the UN, as well as foundations and governments, been slow to react? Because it seems like this was a confluence of events that, i.e.,
oil prices are now more expensive, that you had distribution problems with getting food to the people who need it. So you put all those things together, and it just exacerbates a really troubled situation, and we just have a few more minutes.
It's very true that there is a confluence of events, and some of this could have been predicted. Today,
well, we'll talk about what could have been foreseen when we come back. You're going to stay around with us in the next segment. That's
Cassandra Walden, Chief of External Communications at the UNDP.
Food interlocked with energy all over the world.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We are following this morning the results of the Pennsylvania Democratic primary last night. Hillary Clinton beating Barack Obama by about 10 percentage points. She getting about 2.5 million votes, and he getting about 2 million votes. I might actually have to...
2.3. There's about 200,000 vote.
Yeah, 200,000. I think I got those numbers wrong, but basically about a 200,000 vote difference. We're also looking at oil prices, what's going on there, both here in the United States and abroad. And another story high on our list this morning is China. As you said this morning, John, it's unimaginable 19 years ago. It's a very important anniversary for them that China would be hosting the 2008 Olympics as they are right now.
China 19 years ago was hosting a very different kind of event.
Now that's the Tiananmen Square clashes between Chinese law enforcement, police officers, and
military,
the people,
students, workers. I remember it so well. On June 3rd, Ayatollah Khomeini died. I remember. And Tiananmen Square was such a giant story that the Middle East press corps was so angry that they were not going to even get on the front page because Beijing was such an enormous story. And it started very, very small. Little protest posters on walls in Tiananmen Square, then became a protest over the ousting of Hu Yaobang, who was a reformer in the government there in Beijing. And it led to a climax, which was reported all over the world. Here's the BBC from Tiananmen Square on June 4th.
The troops have been firing indiscriminately, but still there are thousands of people on the streets who will not move back. After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
And people around the world were watching these images, watching, hearing the sounds as we just did, seeing some of the pictures. And even to this day, no one can say with any certainty exactly how many people died that day, how many people were wounded. The Chinese government has never released any official numbers. We've
a couple hundred to several thousand.
Up to 7,000, yeah, exactly, was the biggest number that I saw. And even some advocacy groups say to this day, in 2008, there are still 60 people imprisoned in China from the Tiananmen Square clashes.
Well, of course, there's a signature image from that clash, and Amy Wong witnessed that image, as did the rest of the world, on June 4th. 19 years ago today.
The tank did not try to just run him over. It turned to go around him. And then the young man jumps in front of the tank. And then the tank turns the other way and the young man jumps the other side. They did this a couple of times and then the tank turned off its motor. And then it seemed to me that all the tanks turned off their motors.
So Amy Wong recalling the tank man in front of the tank image, an image that's banned in China. That's from a Frontline documentary that was produced in 2006.
And there is some remnants. There is this shadow of Tiananmen Square, which is Chinese officials are debating now whether or not to ban live coverage from Beijing, from Tiananmen Square during the Olympics this summer. They're concerned about more protests, as we've seen as the torch has gone around the world.
You can go to our website. We have a link to the Frontline documentary and more pictures of Tiananmen Square.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's time for the latest headlines. Femi Oke, what's happening today?
I have some breaking news just coming in from our colleagues at the BBC about Zimbabwe's recount. You may remember the elections were in March. We still don't have a result. But the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission says that the ZANU-PF, the ruling party, has won the first of the recount votes for one constituency. The Movement for Democratic Change, the opposition party, actually say that it's all part of rigging the election. Let's move on to sports now, and I look at sports. The NHL quarterfinal playoffs finished up last night. The Philadelphia Flyers took their series against Washington with a 3-2 overtime win. Semifinals start tomorrow with Philadelphia moving on to Montreal and Colorado heading to Detroit. Jack Long seemed at ease in his new role as the NFL's number one draft pick for the Miami Dolphins.
Jake Long.
I should get his name right because he's worth $30 million. Yeah. He's very happy about that, I can tell you.
I want to thank my agents and the Miami Dolphins for getting this deal done. So now I can just concentrate on football. Don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Just worry about getting in here playing.
That was Jake Long.
Yeah, he could stick around. That's guaranteed money.
He's my new best friend.
What do you mean guaranteed?
It means no matter what he does. I mean, I guess he has to actually show up on the field.
Is this what it's gotten to? This is what the business of
every other
the
sport
NFL?
Has guaranteed money. It's unique to the NFL that they have no guaranteed money. That's, you know, that's one of those NFL things. But Jake is part of history, I guess. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Our big story today, Pennsylvania. We've been talking about the primary results there where Hillary Clinton beat Barack Obama. But it's not the end of the road for the Democratic candidates. Now it's on to Indiana and North Carolina, which hold their primaries on May 6th. So it's going to be two primaries in one day. We've invited Micah Schweitzer, the news director at WNIN in Evansville, Indiana, and Mark Johnson, the political reporter at the Charlotte Observer, to give us a view from where they are sitting. And let's start with you, Micah, in Evansville, Indiana, where the polls have been basically a dead heat between Barack and Hillary.
That's right. It's 50-45 in the most recent poll. The margin of error is 4.2%, and so it's pretty close, too close to call, certainly. And it's obvious that both candidates are going to be very active in trying to win Indiana's May 6th primary. 72 delegates are at stake, and both candidates, Barack Obama, of course, was here last night and is campaigning some more today in Indiana, and Hillary Clinton is arriving later today for a campaign event in Indianapolis. So both candidates very active in Indiana right now.
Do you think there'll be any bounce for Hillary Clinton out of her win last night in Pennsylvania? What are some of the issues that the folks in Indiana are worried about?
Well, I've been thinking about that because jobs, like in Pennsylvania, jobs and the economy are ranking really high as the top issues here. Most of the ads that we're seeing from both campaigns are dealing with economic issues, and so so it's very likely that both candidates will be looking to try to appeal to blue-collar voters and mm-hmm. working-class voters. They're both going to be trying to get the message out that they are the ones who can bring jobs back and keep jobs in the U.S. Like Pennsylvania, this is a manufacturing state, and mm-hmm. a number of jobs have been lost. And so there are probably going to be a lot of people watching the outcome of Pennsylvania as they seek to determine what to do with their own.
Yeah, no question. And Mark Johnson, you're watching things in North Carolina where Barack Obama has been polling ahead of Hillary Clinton. I think I've seen polls anywhere from 5 points to 19 points ahead. But as we all know, sometimes polls just don't turn into any reality as voters go to the polls. What's your thought there?
Well, he definitely has a pretty solid lead here. And if you sort of average all the polls, and it could be, you know, as high as 15%. But both candidates are still going all out, and they're basically hitting the same issues that they're hitting in a lot of other states, and that's because, unlike, say, 10 years ago, North Carolina's economy and electorate is a lot more like the rest of the country. I mean, a few years ago when candidates came in here you know, they had to make the nod to the tobacco quota system, and then, you know, maybe toward
the tobacco quota system,
exactly, which no longer exists because we are the number one tobacco producing state, and that was something that the candidates had to talk about. They had to, you know, reassure the farmers they were going to support that program. Well, they don't mention that anymore, and they don't give the nods to the conservative side of certain issues because the electorate has changed.
But there's an interesting contrast between North Carolina and Indiana in the sense that Indiana is a more traditional manufacturing economy that's in some difficulty, whereas in North Carolina, you've got a large service economy, a sort of a high-tech economy there outside of Charlotte, plus a sizable African-American population. Seems to me to be Barack Obama country all the way around.
Right. We've transformed from, I mean, we used to be tobacco, textiles, and furniture. Well, all those things have gone away. And now it's banking, high-tech, pharmaceuticals, things like that, like, you know, like I said, from, you know, similar to the rest of the country. And as you point out, you know, anywhere, you know, potentially as high as, you know, 40% of the Democratic primary vote could be African-American.
Well,
40%, huh?
40%, yeah, it's big. Well, Mark Johnson, thank you very much. We'll check in with you next week as we get closer to the primary. Also, Micah Schweitzer joins us from Evansville, Indiana. We'll check with both of you guys next week. Thank you very much. Politics in North Carolina and Indiana.
40% African-American in North Carolina. I didn't know that.
Big.
That's the takeaway for me today.
That's the takeaway, yes. And again, another state that's like shocked to be decisive in the Democratic primary. Speaking of shocked to be decisive, the NBA playoffs are underway. And yes, it was another exciting game of watching the San Antonio Spurs last night.
6-point game. Diaw guarded by Ginobili in the three. Rebounded by Stoudemire. He hit one 3 moments ago. He tees up another missing game. Parker's got it. Zeroes on the clock. And San Antonio is going up 2 games to none.
Yes.
The defending champions have held
the few words that the NBA hates more than any other, San Antonio wins another game. Yes. I think NBA is counting on a bigger rivalry in the NBA playoffs, but the defending champs are certainly have to be considered the favorites, at least headed into the playoffs.
If they win, they deserve to be in the finals.
Of course they do. And joining us now,
they
absolutely. No, they're defending
trophy
champs. I'm just trashing them because I'm sick of them. But Henry Abbott joins us from the True Hoop blog. Henry, tell us about some of the other big matchups in the NBA playoffs. I'm certainly loving the Lakers-Boston.
Yeah, well, that's what you and a bunch of NBA executives are holding their breath for that one. It's still the first round, though. Right now, I don't know if you caught any of New Orleans-Dallas last night, but it's like the coronation of Chris Paul right now, where he's, you know, he's an extremely young player, but he did almost everything he did with the ball last night was absolutely perfect and turned out so well. And the Mavericks are heavyweights, but they don't seem to be able to get even close to the Hornets right now. So that's exciting.
The Nuggets. How do you feel about the Nuggets?
They might win a game or two. I think the Lakers are heavily favored in that series. San Antonio obviously supposed to be almost like a preview of the would be Western Conference Finals, but it hasn't really panned out that way.
We got Boston, Atlanta.
Atlanta, no chance.
No chance. Yeah, I think it was something like a 20-point margin last night, or short of a 20-point margin.
The differential between, by some fancy new stats, you can measure like how good a team is. It proves to have pretty good predictive value when you look at how much they won by on average all year long. The Celtics won by one of the biggest margins in NBA history on average, and Atlanta usually lost games. And so the discrepancy there is one of the biggest in any playoff series history, which means, you know, Boston are just massive favorites.
Well, that's a great digest of the NBA playoffs. And Henry, you know, even the Knicks have something to be happy about this playoff season, right? You know what I'm talking about?
What do they have to be happy about?
Isaiah's gone, man.
Oh, right.
He's pretty much gone, right? He's not entirely gone.
Isn't this a very odd setup? Donnie Walsh, who was one of his mentors, who gave him his first coaching job at the Indiana Pacers, comes into the Knicks and says, okay, Isaiah Thomas no longer going to be coaching the team, but he's going to be here advising me, though he can't have any contact with any of the team members.
Can't have contact with women, team members.
What's going on with that?
Well, there's been kind of a parlor game among NBA journalists of what is Isaiah's connection to James Dolan. Does he have some dirt on him? Or there's actually been some speculation, unfounded, that maybe Isaiah had some connection to upcoming free agents, and by having him around, they'd have inside track on some big name free agents. But
maybe Isaiah actually owns Madison Square Garden. We don't really know about that. Henry,
I think the thing is he
quickly.
Yeah, they haven't been able to settle on a buyout, and so in the meantime,
right,
they're willing to paying the rest of his money, so he's hanging around.
And Dolan's hates the press. So Henry Abbott, thank you very much, author of the True Hoop blog.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a takeaway response. Man, Dean shouldn't even be involved in this. I still question his sanity after that screaming episode. That's Franklin Dart in Evansville, Indiana. They're going to be voting there in Evansville. And our question today is, as this Democratic nomination process just limps forward, what should Howard Dean, the head of the DNC, do? How should he resolve this? We want to hear from you at mytake@thetakeaway.org or at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And I want to give the last word to Cassandra Walden, who's Chief of External Affairs here at the United Nations Development Program. I mean, this food story that we were talking about earlier, this is the story of our era, I think.
Absolutely.
Don't you believe?
Absolutely. It's impacting all of us.
And it's like nuclear proliferation.
Absolutely. We're calling it a silent tsunami because it's really sweeping the globe. It's impacting all of us, both in New York and in Southern Africa.
Cassandra, thanks for joining us. That's all for The Takeaway this hour. We'll see you online, takeaway.org.
Major funding for The Takeaway is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, with additional funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation, the Freeman Foundation, and the Star Foundation. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.